Welcome back to another episode of the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix. Well, we are a couple weeks away from the start of training camp, so no better time to check in with Bobby Marks, a former assistant general manager in Brooklyn, and of course, the Vertical's front office insider. Cover a lot of ground here with Bobby, including how Boston looks with Al Horford, a new hope in Philadelphia, and what are reasonable expectations for the Lakers this season. Let's go.
Yahoo Sports presents the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix. Powered by digital media. Find your voice. And now, your host, Chris Mannix.
Well, it's hard to believe that we are less than 2 weeks away from the opening of NBA training camps. You've got media days for most teams on September 26th. That's a Monday. Camp opens after that. The preseason schedule in early October. And we're just off to the races. Maybe it's the Olympic cycle being this year. Maybe it's the once again having a frenetic free agency period, but this offseason seems like it is one of the shorter in recent memory. But there's a lot to digest and a lot to dig into as we head into this season. In addition to wondering, are we headed towards a work stoppage at the end of this season? Talk more about that and everything else. We'll bring in Bobby Marks, the front office insider over at the Vertical, former assistant GM with the Brooklyn Nets, and he joins me on the phone for this podcast. Bobby, give me, from your experience, 2 weeks out from when training camp opens, what are NBA front offices doing right now?
Well, hopefully when you go into the gym, you hear the noise of a ball bouncing. That's going to be the biggest thing. You want most of your guys in town. You usually start seeing guys trickle back in right after Labor Day, as you said, we're about 10 days out from camp. You should start to see a full gym with guys, with your coaches out there working with individual players. Of course, the goal is to get into camp healthy, so you don't want any setbacks, leading up the next couple weeks here. But you want your full complement of players back, within the next couple weeks, just to get it some unity. I know there's been teams like New York have kind of gone off to different places and have worked together, but the one sound you do want to hear is that ball bouncing.
Yeah, and I would argue that even if they can't hear that ball bouncing, they better hope for a lot of teams that the ball's been bouncing collectively for a little while now. I mean, I go back to Washington last year, and I thought one of the problems Washington ran into at the start of the season was that their guys weren't prepared to play the up-tempo style that Randy Whitman wanted to play last season. And as a result, they were not in shape come camp, and they couldn't get in the right shape early on. And I thought that really sabotaged what they were trying to do at the start of the season. I mean, how important is it for guys to have been doing this for a while? I mean, LeBron James had his, his players-only camp. I know James Harden has tried to organize something similar. I mean, how big is it when guys can do that and get together in late August and early September in advance of camp?
Well, it's huge, especially how we've seen the coaches kind of turn over here. That we're looking at eight, nine new coaches come training camp. So for a guy to show up a couple days before camp starts, that's really sending the wrong message. You don't want to use camp as a time to get into shape, because a lot of things can go wrong there. We can see injuries. We'll see some hamstrings possibly. Guys come in out of shape, and there's always one or two that kind of get themselves into shape, and it's different than, playing one-on-one than getting into practice and being on the floor for 2 years. And, I remember when Byron took over, Byron Scott, in I believe it was 2000, we had a lot of guys that, came into camp looking to get into shape, and it really sent the wrong message, and it kind of, prolongs, especially for new coaches, for them trying to implement a system, offense, defense, kind of put their philosophy where you're kind of spending more time on, on conditioning than X's and O's.
Yeah, and I wonder about that and you mentioned the Knicks and what they are trying to do this year. I've seen a lot of pictures of Knicks players working out. The problem is I've seen them working out with Russell Westbrook, whether it's Porzingis and was it Hernan Gomez I saw a picture of online somewhat recently. I mean, these guys seem to be in Camp Russell for whatever that's worth. But bringing the Knicks together like this, what do you foresee being kind of their biggest challenge? Because that's a talented group on paper. Injuries, age, all these stuff is factors. But what do you see being their biggest challenge as they head into camp?
Well, it's a delicate balance. You've got a roster, a starting five that you know, looks good on paper, but certainly have some question marks from a health standpoint when we talk about Rose, Noah, you know, Carmelo, you know, always lingers around. You know, Lee and Porzingis, you know, have been healthy at least, you know, last year and everything. And you've got Jeff Hornacek, you've got a new coach there, and you've got really not much of a safety net with that bench. So you don't want to put a heavy workload when camp starts with this group, because the one thing you can't afford is, you know, if it's Derrick Rose or if it's Courtney Lee or, you know, even, you know, Noah to an extent, to start the season at, you know, half strength here. So how do you kind of find that fine line with Jeff Hornacek and a lot of new faces? And the bench thing will be a lingering issue, you know, when we get going here, just because there's so many new faces, and it's not like it's a bench built on veterans. We have, you know, a bunch of European players here. We've got Sasha there, Brandon Jennings coming off an injury. So there's not that much, not like there's reinforcements waiting in the wings here.
I tell you what, I might be in the minority here, but I have pretty high expectations for Derrick Rose. Call me crazy, but I believe this guy has a big season left in him. And it's not just the contract year stuff. It's that what I saw from him last year were occasional shades of the player I once saw. I mean, first of all, he was as healthy as he's been since, what, his MVP season, playing 66 games last year. But, you know, usually when guys are coming off these types of major knee injuries, and Rose is kind of different because he had so many of them, but that first year where they're fully healthy, they're not the player they're going to be. They've still got, you know, Derrick Rose might not turn into the player Derrick Rose once was, but I think he's going to be a better version of the player he was last year, which beyond the mediocre three-point shooting, he was pretty good last year in the 66 games he played.
Well, he kind of goes into a different role now. You know, he goes from Chicago's favorite son, and I agree, he'll never be that player that we saw pre-injury in that Philadelphia series. But you've got your complementary players and your supporting cast, you know, especially when you have a player like, you know, with Carmelo Anthony there. And from a health standpoint, I think this is as healthy as he's been. He did put string together a good amount of games last year. And, you know, and I don't buy into the contract year also. I think a lot of it, what it's going to come down to is what kind of system Jeff Hornacek can play. And from a pride standpoint, you know, you're looking at a player or point guard who's still in the prime of his career, late 20s, who still has a lot to prove here.
Yeah, that's probably what I'm most interested in with the Knicks, is how they play. And I don't think we're going to learn how they're going to play on media day. I don't think Hornacek's going to come out and whatever he says, I think it might be a little bit different than what we actually see. But if I start to see principles of the triangle out there, I'm just going to lose all confidence it's going to work. I think Jeff Hornacek needs to do whatever he wants to do out there, whether it's playing up-tempo like he did in Phoenix, creating something different. It just can't be this combination of what we saw, you know, last year with the triangle and Phil and whatever Jeff decides to do. I just feel like it's so important, and I talked about this with Frank Isola, but it's so important to allow the coach to have complete autonomy in how he runs his team. And if I see Jeff and the Knicks playing the triangle, I'm not going to believe it. I'm not going to believe it's an autonomous situation.
Well, and that's the benefit of camp, because you can experiment with a lot of different ways you can play, as far as, you know, trying to mix and match especially with your lineup. And as we talked about, there are so many new faces there that you can do that. And if the triangle kind of comes about, and we had it in New Jersey when, you know, with Byron and Eddie Jordan, where we used the Princeton offense, but we used pieces of it and everything. So if, you know, can you use parts of the triangle and also implement with Jeff's trying to do there and everything? And I think they can, but the weeks leading up to the season, the 4 weeks there, is going to be, you know, they're one of the teams you kind of shine put a spotlight on and see, you know, and monitor their preseason games and see what kind of identity this team is going to be.
I'm just glad the Knicks are going to be interesting, because it's been too long. It's been so many years of horrible basketball with that team. I'm just glad that they're going to be somewhat interesting this year.
Peter King here, reminding you to subscribe and listen to all new and archived episodes of the MMQB podcast with Peter King, as well as the MMQB podcast with Albert Breer and the 10 Things MMQB podcast.
All right, let's talk about Golden State and what we've seen not just from them this offseason, but what we saw from the Golden State players playing together at the Olympics last month. Do you look at what we saw with Klay Thompson and Kevin Durant and Draymond Green playing together? I mean, how much of that is a positive for this team as they head into training camp?
Well, it's a positive because, you know, not many, you know, there's only a handful of these players that get to play at that high level in August. You know, a lot of these guys are doing their own individual work and everything, and when you can put yourself on an international stage and be able to play with each other and spend time off the court, you know, that's a huge positive. You know, my concern with the Warriors is that, you know, and I think we can look at a couple teams here, is that what kind of hangover effect from an Olympic standpoint. And you have to remember, these, you know, with Green and Thompson, you know, you played into mid-June here. Durant played into, you know, late May. And, you know, another team that's bench is kind of thin. I know, you know, I know David West kind of anchors that, and you've got Livingston and Iguodala back too. But kind of how we monitor their workload in you know, late September, most of, you know, of October leading into the season, because there are a lot of players who've logged some heavy minutes, you know, and haven't really caught their breath with, you know, catching a break here and everything. So that will be something to watch. And I wouldn't be surprised if they do get off to a slow start, and it won't be because of trying to integrate Durant, but it will be because, you know, you're kind of managing guys' minutes because it is such a long season. And, you know, for them to get off to how they did last year, that would kind of be more surprising for me than anything. You know, I still believe they'll be there standing at the end in June, you know, either holding a championship or being in the finals. But you just have to, you know, kind of work hand in hand with that training staff there.
Do you think there's going to be a uniform way that teams try to defend them? In other words, are we going to, you know, and I'm really looking forward to watching this and, you know, talking to scouts and other coaches about how they, you know, plan their basic defense. Do you think there's going to be some kind of, all right, well, we're going to leave, you know, Draymond Green open at all times, or we're not going to double team anybody at all times? What do you think the general defensive philosophy is going to be against them?
Well, hopefully you can implement a no shot clock during the season. You know, maybe we can put the four corners back in play and everything. But it's kind of pick your poison with this group. And I think a lot of it will be dictated. And I think you'll see teams try to slow the game down. And I think the interesting part is we get into the playoffs and we see teams value possessions more. You know, it's almost like every possession matters. And will teams take that approach when the regular season starts? You know, and I know it is a regular season games, but if you turn over the ball against this team, you're going to be in for a long night and everything. And, you know, we've talked about it all along when they did add Durant in early July, is that when they end the game with that lineup and you can kind of put Iguodala out there and I guess you can take Patchouli out, it's kind of, you know, who do you defend? And you're basically going to have to, you know, man up here. And is it, do you leave Green alone, or do you kind of, you know, lag off him? You know, is that an option to go? It could be, but he's still an effective. He's an all-star right there. And that's going to be the challenge for teams, especially not during the course of the game, but when we get down to crunch time, as far as, you know, who is going to be your, you know, who's the X factor on that team, and you know, who's your priority? Of course, it's going to be Curry, Durant, then Thompson, then Green, and then it, basically Iguodala is going to be your fifth option.
I think the only thing that you can try to do there is to slow the game down, make it a street fight, try to beat them up on the boards when they go at that small lineup with Durant at four and Draymond Green at five. I don't know if it's going to be effective. I just think, you know, you said it is pick your poison with that team, but there's no practical way, you know, no obvious way of defending them on the perimeter. I think what you can't do is you can't get into these shooting contests with them. You can't get into a three-point shooting contest with that team. All you can do is kind of muck it up and hope you get ugly out wins against them, I think, anyway.
Well, you can't get in the track meet. That's going to be the key. And I think if you kind of get into a, I guess you can say, an all-star game mentality, then you're definitely going to be in for a long night. And that's where we get back to kind of value and, you know, having a high value on possessions here and everything. And it'll be interesting as far as, you know, how this team goes. You know, their bench, I'm not gung-ho on outside of, you know, with Sean back and Andre back. You know, you've got, you know, Varejao, you know, can he hold up during the year? The Ian Clarks of the world, you know, Patrick McCall, who they drafted in the second round from UNLV, could find a role in that rotation. that will be interesting as far, especially on back-to-back nights when you're probably looking to maybe manage these guys' minutes a little bit more.
Of all the teams in the West, who gives them the toughest series? Because, I mean,
I think it's the Clippers.
And I do too.
And I do like, and I like San Antonio. I mean, I never like to discredit them, but I just, you know, their guards are older, you know, in San Antonio. You know, I don't see them regain their quickness, especially Parker.
He didn't look that good in the time he played this summer.
I mean, it's an older group there. Gasol, you add him, and I know you still have Aldridge and Kawhi and everything, but I think when you look at the Clippers, a healthy Clipper team, you know, you've got that returning five back. You know, we'll see who starts at the three there. I like what they did in the offseason. They basically went bargain shopping with their bench there and everything. They've got a good group of veterans there, and if they can stay healthy, that team gives them gives Golden State the biggest threat.
Yeah, I'd say the Clippers too. I mean, it's the Chris Paul factor is big. His ability to control games and take them over at times is sort of the only thing I could see being kind of a counterbalance to what Golden State does. And even that, I still look at it as a long shot. I mean, you've got to win four games from them. That's all. I mean, Chris Paul might be able to sneak out one win with an amazing performance, but beating them four times, it just seems almost impossible at this point. I mean, we haven't seen anything yet, but it seems extraordinarily difficult.
Well, that's the challenge is four games, and you know, like the likely scenario is that you know you're going to have to win a couple on the road up in Oakland if you get to that point and everything, because how home court's going to be dictated, and you know this Clipper team has never been able to really stay healthy, and that's always been the X factor with them. We've seen Chris Paul miss bunches of games throughout the year. We saw Blake last year in and out. The X factor really will be, and I love how he played this summer, is going to be probably DeAndre Jordan. You know, I think Doc talked about it over the weekend. I saw him quoted somewhere, and you know, he's at an all-star level right now, and how, you know, and can he carry over what he did in the Olympics and into the season and everything? And then you've got, you know, kind of a three-headed monster, and you've got kind of, you know, Redick as that, you know, waiting in the wings, you know, role player along with that bench there and everything. So that's going to be the interesting thing with DeAndre.
So you don't see Golden State getting off to one of those 16-1, 22-3 type of starts?
I don't. I really don't. And I think if you want to maximize these guys' minutes, sure. If you're going to want to play these guys 38 to 40 minutes, then yeah, you can certainly do that. I mean, I haven't looked at their schedule, so I'm kind of talking about just from a player standpoint and how this bench is constructed and everything. But I wouldn't surprise me if they start off 12-4, 12-6, you know, and then everybody starts questioning if Durant's going to be is the key why they got off the slow start here, and it won't be. It's just a matter of kind of managing these guys, you know, from an expectation level, from a health, from their own bodies.
See, I go the other way. I think they get off to a ridiculous start. I get where you're coming from with their bench, but how much worse is their bench this year than what it was last year? They lose Bogut and they lose Festus Ilić, so they're weaker up front. I'll give you that much. But Pachulia is coming off maybe his best season as a pro, statistically anyway, with the double doubles he put up in Dallas. You get West, and I from what I saw from him last year, he still has something left in the tank, so they'll be okay on their front line. They're just I just look at Durant coming in, and he's going to want to prove that he's not a disruptive force. So I think in the first few months of the season, at the very least, maybe even the entire first season, it's going to be, you know, say the right thing, do the right thing, Kevin Durant. And it might be the same way with the entire team. I think they blitz the league right at the top. And honestly, Bobby, I think they make a run at their record. I really do. I think we'll be talking about them, you know, getting to, you know, what is it, 74 wins at the end of the season.
Well, I hope you're right.
It'll be fun.
and it will be interesting, though, because, you know, we talked about them at length last year with that record and everything, and can you possibly do, you know, kind of follow that up? And you know, when we talked about it back in, you know, January and February last year, is that we, you know, why would you ever break up a team and add a piece to, like, Durant with, you know, Barnes and kind of, I guess, Bogut out and everything.
Because Barnes can't shoot.
And if you can duplicate what you did in what start that – you know you possibly you know how you can finish, then Goodness gracious. I mean, we'll be looking at possibly a dynasty because this core group will be intact for the long haul. You won't have to break up this, and the league will be, you know, then we get into next summer figuring out, you know, what happens going forward and everything. But I guess I am in the minority that I do think they could get off to a slow start here based on a lot of different factors.
All right, so you say 12-6, 12-4. I say 16-2, 17-3. Type of start to the season. We'll reconvene on that sometime in December. All right, I want to talk a little bit about Boston, the other team that had a very good offseason. Maybe not a great offseason because they didn't land the biggest fish that they wanted to in Kevin Durant. They didn't get the number one overall pick, which I'm sure they were craving once those ping pong balls put them in the top three. But this was solid, man. I think Al Horford is a round peg, round hole type of fit for this team. I was around them a lot last year, and if you were going to point out one weakness to that Celtic team, it's a low post presence. You just didn't get it from Jared Sullinger. You didn't get it from Kelly Olynyk. And I know that Horford's not your traditional five, a power five, a guy that's going to just dominate in the paint, but he faces you up. He's as good as many guys in the NBA. I think that's a huge addition for them.
Well, I agree, and I'm a big Horford fan just based on how he can play the four and the five, and I remember we talked about this the night of the trade deadline show, and I believe I said, like, hey, I'd push my chips in the middle, and try to get Horford at the deadline, even if it was, you know, risking a Brooklyn pick or one of a future asset, just because I believed, you know, how good he is, and now you get him without have to give up anything. It's a straight free agent signing, and I don't think there'll be any issues implementing him into, you know, what the Celtics do, and kind of, you know, you add, you know, with Jaylen Brown, you know, we probably won't even talk about, Gerald Green, is there to kind of give you a little bit more bench a little more depth at the wing coming off the bench. You've got another year with basically that whole core is back and everything coming off a pretty good year. And now can they take that next step? You know, we've seen them, you know, losing this in the first round in consecutive seasons. And can you get to a second round? Can you get to an Eastern Conference Finals? And I believe you can, because I think so many teams have kind of evened themselves up, especially, you know, Toronto kind of stayed packed, and they had to, basically how their cap situation was. And for Boston, good things are still ahead. You know, they really are. And we talked about, there was a heavy emphasis this past year on this Brooklyn pick, and it was the third pick in the draft. But how the draft is going to shake out in 2017 and 2018, you know, Boston has a chance of getting, in back-to-back years, consecutive probably top five picks here in a very good draft. So the future for them is you know, including right now, is certainly bright.
Yeah, if I'm Boston, my objective is to be an NBA Finals team in 2018. And that might be even then be a stretch. I don't know what Cleveland's going to look like a year and a half or so from now. But this year, the goal should be conference finals. And for me, player development. That's a big thing with the Celtics this year. You know, I was looking through their list of draft picks over the last, you know, 15 plus years. And granted, a lot of these guys have been traded. You moved Joe Johnson back in the day. Jeff Green was traded back in the day at a deal for Ray Allen. But it's been a long time, Bobby, since the Celtics had kind of that homegrown developed star. Now, they've done a great job of acquiring guys when their value was low, Isaiah Thomas being one, Jay Crowder being another, and developing them to a certain degree. But, you know, plucked straight from the draft and developed into a all-star caliber player, they just don't exist on the Celtics roster. And I look down, I have to go back to Paul Pierce in 1998 for the last guy that the Celtics kind of developed that. And there have been kind of a number of misses here, Bobby. You look at Marcus Smart, for example. Marcus Smart, still a ton of potential, but it's not like he took major steps forward in his second year. You got a whole bunch of guys, including Jaylen Brown, from this past draft. I mean, the most important thing for the Celtics has got to be developing the young core of this team so that they're a factor in the years to come for them.
Well, and as good as a job as Danny Ainge and his group have done, I think that's kind of the one blemish for them as far as from a draft standpoint, and taking out what they did this past June with the Jaylen Brown pick and everything. Because when you look at the roster with the R.J. Hunter, the James Youngs, the
James
Rozier,
Young was bad. James Young
Jordan
was really
Mickey's,
bad.
Jordan Mickey's, those guys, that group there, right there. And then you add, you know, the Ben Bentel, you know, from this pass in the second round here is that, you know, which one of those guys is going to be able to crack that rotation? And we haven't even, and I'm not even putting Marcus Smart in that group. And I think what you're going to see with Boston is that there's a good chance one of those guys won't be here. And I'm not going to say Rozier or even Hunter, but when you get to the, you know, there's going to be some tough decisions they need to make during training camp. You know, you've got, you know, James Young, you know, the option you can pick up his fourth year. You've got, you know, Jordan Mickey, you know, kind of back end. And which one of those guys doesn't make the final cut because you've got 16 guaranteed contracts right now. So, and you know, the hard part, and it's a kind of a good problem, bad problem, is that when you have so many assets and you have so many draft picks every year, is that guys just overlap each other. And it's all, you know, and I said it to an agent, you know, a year ago, and he had a client who was kind of struggling to find a role in the league. And I said, the hard part is that, you know, you have 30 draft picks the following June, and those guys are coming in to take his job. And I think when you look at it, James Young, he could be certainly the odd man out because, you know, what is this, year three for him
yeah.
right now? And really hasn't done much, had a, you know, really sporadic summer in Vegas and everything. And you know, that's a guy who was picked in a, you know, from that Brooklyn pick, you know, top 15, top 16 player.
Yeah, and then the fact is there should be an opportunity for a James Young with Evan Turner being gone and perhaps a spot in the swingman rotation there. But I'm with you. I'd be – if there's an odd man out, in this situation, Boston wants to keep somebody else. I can see James Young being waived. I can. I just don't think he's made the necessary strides. Look at his numbers from last year. You know, no significant improvements. In fact, most of the numbers went down. His three-point percentage, only shot 23% last year. His field goal percentage only shot 30% and only played in 29 games, which is right on par with what he did a year ago. But, you know, that's a guy that, you know, out of Kentucky, some decent, you know, hype around him, but never developed. And it is on Danny ultimately. He drafts these guys, and then you always look at the guys he didn't draft after that. The Rodney Hood, for example, in that draft was one that was a big miss on their half. But this is also, to me, the coaching staff, too. They've got to have some responsibility here, especially when it comes to a Jaylen Brown. Like, that's Jaylen Brown and Marcus Smart, their development is going to be not a referendum on Brad Stevens and his staff because they've done such a terrific job coaching up until this point, and Brad, in my opinion, is one of the best young coaches in the entire NBA. But, you know, they have got to prove that they can develop these guys and turn them from raw freshman sophomores in college into, you know, real quality NBA players.
Well, and there should be no reason why, especially for Brown this year, where he's not having a role, you know, in this team's success from a rotation standpoint. And, you know, the one place you don't want to see him is up in Maine playing for that D League team, because it would almost be a wasted year. And I know he would, you know, from a development standpoint, maybe you could say no and everything, but for him to kind of put in those 15, 20 minutes, he's a top three pick. He's got great length. You can play certainly different bunch of ways with him. He's 6'7", as far as if you put him and Crowder on the floor together possibly and go small there maybe. But that's going to be the eye test as far as, you know, where, you know, we can maybe say, you know, with Hunter, a guy picked in the late 20s, you know, Rozier was in the late teens and everything, maybe we can give that more of a pass. But I don't think you can do so if they miss out on Brown here.
How do you know, as an executive, how do you know when it's the right thing to send a guy to the D League to get playing time or keep him around the big club and just be at practices and be around the team?
I think you have to look at how your schedule is set up, and I think if it's, you know, if you're going on the road and if you're spending more time on a plane than on the ground and you know, practice wise, from that standpoint, I think those are kind of the opportune time to do that, just because you send them up to, if it's Maine or, you know, the Nets have a team now in Long Island, can you get more practice? You know, those coaches are an extension of your staff, so they're going to be here with the, you know, the big club in September and October, kind of getting a feel for everything. So it's not like you're just throwing them to another team and you know, kind of throwing them into the wind. So I think a lot of it comes down to how the schedule standpoint comes out from a game standpoint, D-League wise? Is there games where you can maybe get them 3 and 4 nights, you know, maybe back to back, you know, get him some practices instead of, you know, going on a West Coast trip if he's not going to have much of if he's not in the rotation and you're hitting, you know, 3 and 5 nights, you know, something that like that. I think that's where it comes into play as far as from a schedule standpoint.
All right, let's talk about a couple of the teams in the Eastern Conference. Indiana, Larry Bird at the end of the season, you know, made it clear he wanted the Pacers to score more. He let go of Frank Vogel. He made some significant deals, most notably bringing in Jeff Teague to replace George Hill and getting Thaddeus Young for that first-round pick. So Larry kind of put his money where his mouth was when it came to the personnel. I'm not so sure about the coaching change. My memory, Bobby, is that Nate McMillan is more of a methodical type of offense and not the up-tempo style that Larry seems to prefer to want to play. But you know, what do you make of that team? It's one of the more interesting teams, I think, going into training camp.
I like them. I really do. I think they're. You can probably almost, you know, have them kind of in the top four there, maybe. You know, I mean, but there's, as we talked before, there's so many teams that there's little separation. But you know, with Nate, the one positive with you know hiring him is that you also keep the whole staff together, and there's not one coach that kind of you know, really, you know, there wasn't a major overhaul and a defection where, you know, Frank was able to take a bunch of these guys down to Orlando and everything. So you do return. You know, your assistant is bumped to the head, and you've still got the likes of, you know, Popeye Jones and that group on the bench and everything.
Yeah, Dan Burke, too.
Yeah, and I'm you know, I had Thad. You know, we traded for him when I was in Brooklyn. We had him. He had a good year last year. He's the ultimate professional. He's, you know, great contract, can play multiple positions. The Teague addition will be interesting. He returns home. Sometimes that never works out, but I don't think in this case, you know, a kid returning back to Indianapolis, you know, I don't think there should be an issue there. And you've got, you know, one of the best players with Paul George. So I'm a big fan. You've got some depth there. You know, another team that's got to figure out their roster because they've got 16 guaranteed contracts and everything. But I think that team can, even though they do have some new faces at the point and at the four, that team can kind of hit the ground running. You've got a, you know, an all rookie player in Miles, you know, Miles Turner and everything like that, that you can really get off to a good start there.
I loved what we saw in somewhat limited action from Miles Turner last year. I mean, I wondered about him coming into the draft. I mean, he had that kind of awkward gait. I didn't know how he'd thrive in kind of an up-tempo system. But this kid, all the tools that we saw at Texas in that kind of brief period, they all kind of translated to some degree to the NBA. He could shoot the ball. He could, you know, play a little bit off the dribble. There wasn't much this kid couldn't do last year. I'm really excited about what the ceiling is for this kid because, I don't know, it could be pretty high.
Well, and that's the crapshoot of the draft. You know, it really is that how do you know? You know, you're basing it off, you know, a sample at University of Texas, a one-year sample there, and then you kind of bring them into an organization. You try to take some baby steps, and then you throw them into the fire. And some guys can sink, and some guys can swim. And he certainly, you know, he did more than tread water here. So I'm a huge fan. He's got, you know, his age, his upside. You know, he's got Al Jefferson there, you know, who can kind of really take him under his wing and really tutor him. And you don't have to put him out there for 30, 35 minutes. You can almost have an extension of his rookie season and still have him come out and produce and everything. So, you know, you add him with what, you know, with some of these other pieces. And that's the one thing Indiana's always done well with is they've always kind of found those, you know, they've always picked either and they're in a late lottery or they're in they're a team that makes the playoffs, and they've done a good job kind of finding those type of players.
There was a lot of smoke at the end of the season that perhaps Paul George could be on the trade block. It seemed like it was more media-created smoke than it was anything else. I never got any sense from either the Pacers organization or talking to people around the league that Paul George was truly available. But if you're Larry Bird, what would it take to extract Paul George from the roster?
Well, if I'm Larry Bird, what I'm doing is I'm going to his agent, and you know, they've got a starting the 25th of September, George is eligible to get his contract renegotiated, and they're going to have they have some cap space to do so. He's at, you know, where his salary is right now, and he's still that tier one max guy. He's a 20, if it, under this year's cap, you know, he would be a $22 million player. I would go there and entertain and see if he wants to do something and renegotiate his contract and bump that up to max where George is giving back something. He's got a player option there that maybe he can, you know, opt in and mend his contract there. And that's kind of the direction I'm going to go with George and everything. And we saw that with Westbrook, we saw it with Harden, you know, in this past summer, and if I'm Pacer management, that's the direction I want to go with Paul George, because the last thing I want to do is kind of head into next season as, you know, a player going into his last year because he's got that opt out the following year. So that's more of the my thought process is if I'm Larry Bird right now.
I tell you what, I was surprised not just by Westbrook, and granted that took me very much off guard, but even Harden too, like. Yeah, we're kind of conditioned now to believe that these players all crave free agency, that they want to be courted and they want to hold the meetings and they want to feel the love from all these teams, you know, trying to recruit them. But you got Westbrook renegotiating, you got Harden renegotiating. Who knows what Paul George could potentially do? I mean, is this perhaps the start of a new trend, Bobby? Or are these sort of case by case sort of situations?
Well, every team is different. You know, a lot of it's just the power of the dollar. And, you know, when you can put in front of a player, and we always talk about, you know, guys signing one-year deals, you know, to kind of bump their you know, to go into free agency when a cap spike goes up, and how hard it is for guys to turn down when you're handing them a blank check. And in the case of with, you know, Harden and Westbrook to kind of bump their salaries up an additional $10 million this year, that's hard for guys to turn down, you know. And I know it kind of goes hand in hand, and for both players, and they risk a little bit from a free agency standpoint. But I think every team is different, every player is different as far as how they look at things. You know, for both players, still in their prime, they'll have a crack at free agency in a couple of years. It just kind of will be, you know, not right now. Will be, you know, they'll just have to wait a couple of years here.
All right, so Philadelphia is the other team I'm pretty interested in at this point, because I'll tell you what, I'll be on that Amtrak much more than I was before, headed down to Philly to see what that team's going to
look
like.
Make sure they put the heat on in that arena.
That is the coldest shoot-around arena ever, and it's cold during games. But in the wintertime, when they hold shoot-arounds and they're bringing food or whatever it is through those doors, you got to bundle up like you're on the top of a mountain out there.
Well, you know, it also doesn't help that ice under there. You know, you go there on a Saturday, you know, they play one of those 7 o'clock games coming off a hockey doubleheader. Oh, my goodness. In late January and trying to walk from that parking lot, it might be one of the most coldest experiences you'll ever have.
No, it's brutal. It's brutal. But they do finally have a team that's worth talking about. You've got Ben Simmons, the top overall pick, Dario Saric coming over. You've got some of the young players that were already there, headlined by Nerlens Noel. You finally have some intrigue with Philly. Let's start with Simmons, I guess. I mean, you've seen him play in college. You saw him play at Summer League. The guy is unbelievably talented. I mean, he's clearly the number one pick. I mean, there was some debate for a minute and a half about whether it was Simmons or who am I blanking on there? Number two.
Ingram.
Ingram. Brandon Ingram. Yes, I should know that since I wrote about him extensively. But there's no debate in my mind. After watching them play in Summer League, Ingram could be a very good player, maybe even a great player, but Simmons, he's got special talent. What do you think that Brett Brown does with Ben Simmons in the first couple of months of the season?
Well, the one thing that's really, you look at him, is his size and just how big. I think there was a picture that went around a week ago. I think he might have been working out with LeBron and those guys. Just in how big he is. I mean, he is a legit 6'10", and just can play. And if I'm with Simmons and leading up to camp and going into camp, I'm kind of experimenting as far as what the right fit will be. And it's different now, you know, than the summer, where you have guys that are trying to, you know, fight for roster spots. Where now you've got guys. You know, you've got the Gerald Hendersons of the world. You've got the, you know, the Jared Bayless of the world and everything. And you return, you know, with Okafor and Noel and that group and everything. And now it's just a matter of trying to find the right fit, because it's not going to be. And I know all rookies have kind of a developmental curve and everything. But you can throw him into the fire right now and see where he can go, and you wouldn't have any, you know, hesitations about him and everything. And I think the sky is the limit with him. You know, especially now. You know, we get away from the draft. I know we all talked about, you know, a lot of things that happened there with from an agent standpoint and them kind of hiding him in a little bit. But now we're getting into the meat of things, where we focus about the team and not the individual. But I think he can be turned into a really special player there, because The good thing what they did this summer was they went out and got those veterans that I just talked about. It's a little bit different than last year with how the situation with Okafor kind of unfolded. And now you've got a legit point guard. You've got Sergio Rodriguez also. And that's kind of, we saw when they added Ish Smith in late December, when you kind of put a point guard around this group, good things can start to happen here.
Oh, Ish Smith signing was, I mean, they won 6-7 more games with him.
Well, you know what's funny, Chris? I wrote about it when we were doing, I don't know, the Summer Rewind, one of those things, and it felt like they won like 20 more games with him. But they got him when they were like 1-30, and they wound up finishing, 11-12 or something. You know, they won 10 more games, but they were in every game. It felt like they were in every game, and they were competitive. And I think when you can at least put a, and that's where, we can criticize, Sam, Hinkie a lot about what happened, but I think that's one of his biggest, downfalls last year was not putting and I guess he relied on Kendall Marshall being healthy, putting a legit point guard on the floor with that group to give at least them a chance in each night, and I think that's kind of where it stunted, at least, with Okafor and certainly with Noel's, development there.
I think the challenge for Brett Brown in the first few months of the season is going to be teaching these guys to win close games. Now, they weren't in a bunch of close games last year. They're going to be in more close games this year. They're not going to win a bunch, or they're not going to be playoff-type competitive, but some of these games are going to be a lot closer this year. And because they've been so conditioned to lose over the last 2+ years for many of these guys, it's going to be an uphill battle. They're going to look ugly at the end of some of these games, and that's something I think is going to be a daily challenge for Brett Brown, not just to instill the confidence in these guys that they can win, but just putting them in the right positions to actually give themselves a chance to win late in games.
Well, you're right, and I think you can almost add, and not to the same extent as Philadelphia, but you can almost put Minnesota in that equation, with better talent, and you've got certainly with a new coach there and Tom Thibodeau, but what happens when these games actually mean something and you're not in games when you're losing by 20? And, I think Minnesota will be different from Philly because I can see that team challenging for a playoff spot and everything where, we see guys play a lot better down the stretch when your team is 20-50 and things don't really mean anything. But, what happens for Minnesota with an Andrew Wiggins when you're a 500 team at the All-Star break? What does the next 20 games tell you about him? And I think that really dictates, and it's a great learning experience as far as for a player, and it's a great evaluation for a team as far as how do certain players kind of perform in a little bit more of a pressure situation. And I think with Philadelphia, that will be the struggle as far as you've got a lot of new faces there. Hopefully you have Embiid back as far as kind of getting over that hump there, and they certainly will be in a lot of more games than they were the last couple of years. But how can you when you're up three with a minute left and you've got the ball, how can you finish games out there? That's going to be, and a lot of it's just going to be based on a trust level and how they kind of come together during camp and really just build off things.
We beat up on Sam Hankey, and a lot of it is, some of the things he did I vehemently disagreed with, but you mentioned how advantageous a situation Boston's in with the Brooklyn pick for the next couple of years. Philadelphia, kind of the same thing, their own pick, plus the Laker pick is still looming out there, and I don't love this season for the Lakers either. I mean, there's obvious and deserved excitement by Ingram being there. Luke Walton, I think, is the right choice for that job, but it's going to be pretty ugly in Los Angeles too, Bobby. I don't see this being... Now, what are we thinking here? 25-30 wins for the Lakers this year?
I would say between 20-25.
Yeah.
My concern with that group is not right now. It's going to be years 3 and 4 when those Mozgov and Deng contracts kind of really rear its face. And that's going to be – and then what happens if Ingram's your starter by then? And I know we want to focus on the present and not the future, but I'm just kind of looking at long-term for that group there and everything. But I think you'll have a different vibe there. I think it would have been. I don't think you could have gone into a season with a Byron Scott kind of as a lame duck coach, and then really starting this process again. Either mid season or at the end of the year and everything. So that's going to be the goal. And I think it's a lot of it. If it's a lot of these teams with new coaches, if it's Brooklyn, if it's the Lakers, just kind of putting the foundation in place. Then when you can kind of put some positive spin to the year. Then you go into either the trade deadline or, you know, free agency again, you give it another crack, and at least you have some type of product to sell here.
Luke Walton's another guy that I like as a basketball mind. I thought he didn't get, I mean, I shouldn't say he didn't get, I thought he deserved real credit for what he did in the first half of the season with Golden State. It wasn't just roll the balls out and let these guys do their thing. I thought he had an impact on what they did in the first half of the season. If nothing else, just making sure it was a seamless transition from Steve Kerr to himself. But I don't know anything about Luke Walton's coaching philosophies, Bobby. The guy is a player under Phil Jackson for a chunk of his career. He just finished an apprenticeship under Steve Kerr, who plays the opposite of what Phil Jackson likes to play with the triangle. I don't know what his system is going to look like going in. That's one of the more interesting, I think, storylines coming in. What is Luke Walton all about?
Well, that's the big question, and it's a lot different when you shift one seat over. And I know he did it for a sample in Golden State when Steve Kerr was out and everything, but you basically inherited, an all-star team there in Golden State, and you kind of just didn't let the train go off the tracks. You just kind of let it, you were the captain of the ship there, and now you would get a clean surface here. You kind of, you start from scratch and everything, and as far as what is your style of play here. You've got, Russell, Clarkson, we've talked about Ingram. You still have Randall. Now you had veterans with Mozgov and Deng. You've got Calderon. So you've got a mixed match of young youth and veterans, with that group in here. And I think the big thing is really setting expectation levels. And I think if you're going to go in there saying that this is a playoff team and we should be fighting for the seventh and eighth spot, I think you're setting yourself up for a fall. And I know it's a big market and everything, but you really got to start taking some baby steps here.
All right, I'll finish with New Orleans. A team that was right up there in my mind as one of the bigger underachievers last year. I mean, you have Anthony Davis, one of the generational type of talents on that roster, and it just didn't seem to come together the way I thought it would under Alvin Gentry. They made a whole host of changes this offseason. They draft Buddy Hield. They sign a whole bunch of lesser-known guys headlined by what I think is ridiculous money for Solomon Hill to come down and play there. What do you make of what they did this offseason? I'll put it more specifically. Are they better prepared to play Alvin Gentry basketball this season?
Well, they've got a new roster to do so, and I think that's the hard part. I think you can look at him and Fred Hoiberg in Chicago, and when you inherit a group like both them did last year, it's hard to kind of put your fingerprints all over. And now you basically in New Orleans, you've turned over that. You mentioned Hill, and I get nervous about guys who don't get, and I've said this all along, who don't get their fourth year option picked up, and to give him a boatload of money. Really based off, a Toronto series and some good moments during the year. And what happens when that player has that money? Are you going to get 5-6 points per game off him? And I like some of their other signings, with Moore and, I guess, Galloway. The big question, and it came, over a week ago, is that, is the Drew Holiday absence. And I applaud him for taking that approach with his wife and everything, but we saw last year when he was out, they certainly struggled. They had that rotating door with the point guard. So how long is he going to be out if it's an extended period of time? And with that group, a lot of it does come down to health, because you do return Davis, you've got Ajinka, Sheik, that group there. Tyreke Evans, is he the odd man out with Lance Stevenson now on board? Because you've got to figure out something with your roster there. So there's certainly still a lot of questions there. I don't think you can pencil them in as a playoff team. I think they're going to be one of those teams that are going to fight to try to get in if the stars line up and everything.
They have a lot of talent on that team, as they did last year, but they also have a bunch of guys that I thought they hold the basketball too long. And what I mean is sort of you got Tyreke Evans, a ball dominant guard. Drew Holiday, he's a little more ball dominant, I think, than some other point guards that are out there. I feel like this whole offense needs to flow through Anthony Davis. Everything kind of needs to flow through Anthony Davis. I also think that Davis last year was a little too focused on proving to everybody he could be a three-point shooter. I felt he came out last year and was jacking threes when he didn't need to. I mean, if the three-point shot for Anthony Davis is there and he thinks he can make it, by all means, go ahead. But this guy's at his best offensively anyway when he is creating monster mismatches. If there's a smaller guy on him, he posts him up, he shoots over him. Bigger guy, you take him off the dribble, you just go at him, you crush him. all this, you know, Davis to me was trying a little bit too hard last year to be a star.
Well, and now you add, you know, when you're talking about holding the ball, you know, you add Lance to that mix too. So, you know, where are we going here with that group? And I think for this team to thrive, I think they've got to kind of get up and down a little bit here and kind of get away from, and you've got to figure out, and for this team, they're, and it's a shame because they're kind of, there's a log jam at center with Sheik and Jinka, is that you maybe put Davis at the five and that's kind of where you go and you play through him and everything. So that's going to be the interesting, you know, thing with the Pelicans here and everything. But they're another team that's got to stay healthy. You know, they've got Pondexter back. I don't see Evans. You know, I would not be surprised if he is a camp casualty at the end of October and everything. And I know he's got a high number and everything.
Huge number.
But I think, you know, when you're looking at New Orleans, you know, you can kind of, you know, you can, I guess you can bite the bullet and stuff, especially if Stevenson comes out and has a strong preseason, because you look at that roster, I don't know who that odd man out could be.
Man, if Tyreke Evans gets cut in favor of Lance Stevenson, that would be something. That would be something.
It's the NBA. Anything can happen, you know?
Lance Stevenson. Wow. A few years ago. 5 years, $35 million now, or what is it? $45 million, I think it was. Now, clinging to an NBA career, and he and Tyreke Evans jockeying for potentially one roster spot. Amazing. All right, Bobby, I appreciate it, man. Know you're busy, and we'll catch up soon.
Thanks, Chris.
That's it. My thanks to Bobby Marks for joining the show. Don't forget, if you like this episode, and if you like this podcast in general, feel free to give us a rating, leave a comment. You know I appreciate it. As always, you can download this podcast and other archive podcasts on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, really anywhere you can download podcasts. While you're there, check out the Vertical Podcast with JJ Redick and the Vertical Podcast with Woj. We'll see you next week.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.